that time. So he gets an X, and then he gets a W. Besides the fact that I screwed up the extra credit quiz, how many of you took it? Okay, good. So at least y'all got a chance to get some extra credit. That's good. The opportunity was yesterday, so if you didn't take it, it's too late. But you definitely have to watch the syllabus review video. I did screw up, as Matt pointed out. There were two things I was off on. The due date for the topic, which is when is it supposed to be?
January 26th.
Correct. A week from Friday. And the other date I screwed up on was the final exam, which is when?
Not the 26th.
Not the 26th. Yes, very good. Not the 26th.
May 9th.
What? May 9th. Yep, May 9th. All right, very good. So if you got those questions wrong, I will give you full credit. Who are you?
Jacob.
Jacob. All right, very good. Because I never penalize students for my bad. So I will take that into account when I do the calculations. All right, so topics. We'll start off with topics. Your topics are due 1 week from Friday. How are you going to give me your topics? Or how are you going to get your topics to me?
Just email you?
Just going to email me, right. Do I need a thesis statement? No, I don't know. What all do I need? Just what you going to write about? Now, for your class, yeah, you might have a little hard time with topics because the topics must be related to the class. So we're only talking about one major historic event. So obviously it's going to be something dealing with World War I. But what does that translate to you, for you? Well, very simple. You could talk about a historical figure, someone like the Red Baron. You could talk about a particular battle, the Battle of the Somme. You could talk about a technological development, the invention of what became known as tanks, you know, something like that. The development of chemical weapons. But the other thing is there are also some topics that may not be too famous, like the fact that there was actually naval battles that took place between the Germans and the British down off the coast of Argentina. There was military battles between the Germans and the Japanese in China. You know, so there are things that if you really, really wanted to dig down, you could find some information with. But at the end of the day, it has to be something related to the war. What if you're not into all the military stuff? Well, you could talk about the transformation that took place in uniforms. You could talk about how post-war, because of the war, that's ultimately which really boosted the desire to, at least in the United States, to go for women's suffrage. You know, because just like it happened in World War II, a lot of the women ended up going to the factories to work to help make weapons for the men when they went overseas. You could talk about the development of the Red Cross or anything along those lines. You could get really creative. You could talk about the pandemic that took place during the midst of it, the Spanish flu. So there's so many aspects. So what you're going to need to do is you're going to have to think creatively. My other classes that are survey classes, they can open up the book and look at the index. You guys might be able to do that if you bought the book. Hopefully you're going to get the books in the glossary. Or, again, just do some Google searches. Think about something you like, sports and World War I. See if you could do something like that. Another fascinating topic, which always astounded me, was the Christmas truce of 1914. Fascinating topic. So there's so much you could do, but you just got to get creative with it. The key thing you've got to remember, though, is can you write about it in essentially what's going to amount to an 8-page paper? So you can't do something broad. You can't talk about all of the weapons that were used in the war, but you might be able to do a compare and contrast between like the standard issue rifles that were used by the armies. You could do something like that. Because ultimately at the end of the day, if it's too broad, you're not gonna be able to write about it. Just like if it's too narrow, you're not gonna be able to write about it. So spend some time over the weekend, give it some thought. If you want to bounce a couple of possibilities off of me, be my guest. I got a kind of crazy day tomorrow. I got a kind of crazy day on Saturday, but I should be around like Sunday afternoon. So I will be checking my email and I'll get back to you. And I'll help guide you. If there's something you're absolutely convinced you know what you're going to talk about,
go for it. That's fine too.
And don't try using that same paper that you used last time, because that's going to apply as well, but you got to do something fresh.
It was a good paper, though. I think I liked your paper.
Yeah.
All right, any questions about the paper? Yes.
Could you talk about something like alt history, like if Germany won instead of the Allies? Like, could you do something like that?
I might let you do a creative thing like that. The challenge is going to be the facts. So you'd have to find some particular event that, you know, the what if. You know, what if this happened as opposed to that? So you use cited facts up to that point and then you go off. That might be interesting. Might be interesting. I would want to talk about that more as it was developed, though.
Because I was thinking something more along the lines of Germany doesn't start up unrestricted submarine warfare, so then the U.S. never comes in the war. So then you have the Germans just completely overwhelmed the Entente.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably what would have happened.
Well, yeah, because at that point, Russia was basically out of the war. You had the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and they were beginning to redeploy all of the men and materiel from the east to the west. So.
Yes, because of this, it was the communist revolution in
Russia. Yeah, the rise of Lenin. Bolshevists, yeah. That might work. That might work. Yep.
Obviously, the main topic has to stay within the time period of World War One.
Yep.
Does it have to be entirely self-contained within that time period? Could you do like a compare and contrast to whatever your topic is and what it ended up evolving into in the coming World War later?
Might be interesting. I might allow you to do that. You could pick like one of the outcomes, I guess. That might be possible. Again, just flush it out, put it in words, and we can think about that. One other thing I do want to mention, I don't think I remember to mention it to other classes, is that if you change your mind, absolutely feel free, you can change topics. But you just got to let me know. That's all I ask. Okay? Anything else? Any questions from the syllabus video? For the most of you that watched it. Okay, cool. Books? The books in the bookstore? Both of them?
At least one of them is.
One of them is?
No, both of them.
Both of them are? Okay. Yeah, the not whoever is in the manager over there, but the company, Foliette, was giving me a hard time because I didn't want to use a textbook. I wanted to use a paperback booklet.
So at least they're both there. And it shouldn't cost you that much money. $30 tops. So, All Quiet on the Western Front, if you're going to do that, that would be a source of extra credit for you guys. So, like I said, just pick a couple of chapters out of there and just kind of tell me what happens. Do it 2 or 3 pages, submit that. I'll consider that as extra credit. Also, the other thing I mentioned for you guys on the video is if you watch any World War One related video. Obviously, there was the movie that is on Netflix of All Quiet on the Western Front. That came out superb. I love that. So if you want to talk about, you know, from that aspect, you can do that as well. But obviously the book is always better than the movie. So whichever route you'd rather go. There's also 1917. That was really good. Just the videography of them going from one trench to the other through no man's land. You know, that was very, very realistic. So that was superb. So there's definitely options out there. Because one of the things that Lemanic always tries doing is giving lots of extra credit options. All right, so Franco-Prussian War, hugely significant war in the fact that it changed the map of Europe. And once the map of Europe changed, the political makeup of Europe also began to change. On one hand, out of nowhere, you had the most powerful continental country, literally created as a consequence of the Franco-Prussian War. Deutsch Einigung, which is German for German unification, occurred. The 26 separate independent countries unified under the imperial authority of the King of Prussia, who was crowned Kaiser. Let's rub some salt in the wound. In the Palace of Versailles. The Palace of the Sun King, Louis XIV.
As a symbolic FU to the French. Of course, under the terms of the Treaty of Frankfurt, as we know, Germany got additional territory. They got Alsace and Lorraine, which was taken from France. And they got a huge indemnity, cash, that had to be paid. Well, here's the catch. In order to get a portion of the money, the German states had to agree to be part of the empire. If they didn't want to be part of the empire, they wouldn't get any money. So all 25 others willingly submitted to the Kaiser. But many of the states still had their own kings. So that's the reason why what was created was called the Second Reich, the Second Empire, the Second German Empire. And fascinatingly so, you took the economies, the military capacity, the industrial capacity of 26 different countries and fused it together. Never before in the history of human civilization has 26 countries put aside their differences, joined together in collaboration by signing a piece of paper. And the outcome was power. Militarily, educationally, economically, scientifically, you name the metric. Germany was either number one or number two or three by any measure. And this was the long-held dream of the German nationalists because they had a vision of grandeur. Of course, the problem was, is once you get a taste of success, you want more. On the other hand, where you saw the creation of a new empire, you saw the complete destruction of another. The French Empire under Napoleon III collapsed. And in its place was established the French, or the Third French Republic. La Troisième République. They went away for the third time in their history from monarchy. And instead would create a new state. Now, of course, the irony was, one of the reasons why the French decided to get rid of their imperial system was because Napoleon surrendered at the Battle of Sedan. I told you that last class.
Do you want an incompetent buffoon as the head of your country? He exposed himself. So the French said, go pound sand.
Instead, the parliament, the legislative body, would take control. And they would begin making a new state. Initially, a temporary government, known as the Provisional Government, formed. It was filled with many of the former leaders in the parliament. And they began enacting in parliamentary democracy. Ironically, once Napoleon was captured, it was the provisional government that kept the war going. Had the provisional government not done so, the Franco-Prussian War would have been over in September. But the only reason why it lingered on for more months is because the French were like, we're going to keep fighting, which only resulted in the defeat of two other armies and deaths of many more thousands. Because the one thing the French have always been good at is starting wars. But what have they not been good at? Fighting wars. And in the end, they lost completely. Had
the scale of their defeat occurred 200 or 300 years before, the Prussians probably would have wiped out the French civilization. But because it was a more modern time, they didn't have the ability to implement the type of control that they could have back during the 14 or 1500s. So the Germans themselves were condemned to negotiate the peace, to take the land that had the coal, the resources in it, and to get money out of it. And then let the French figure it out themselves. Because who wants to control the French? They're French. No offense if any of you are French. But remember, history, historically speaking, the French were always the bad guys. I've already talked about this, the Paris Commune. We're not going to worry about that. Boom, this is where we're going to go. Once the war was over, by 1875, they would hammer out a new constitution. This would be dominated by a system similar to England's, except there was no king. So there were two chambers in their legislative branch, an upper chamber and a lower chamber, and they had a parliamentary cabinet government where a prime minister was chosen and the heads of the different departments ran the show. All right. One outcome of the Franco-Prussian War, new powerful country. Other outcome, an old country was toppled, completely embarrassed. And here's the biggest point I want you to remember. Because of how humiliating it was, the French people wanted, demanded revenge. And they wanted to show that they were not pansies and pushovers. So they were prepared to get more aggressive elsewhere in the world.
Now, just as a point of context, we don't have to remember any of these details. This is also the beginning of the era of new imperialism. So French colonial forces began going across North Africa, as well as penetrating into Southeast Asia. They would take control of what would become Vietnam during this time period. They also would go from Madagascar. They would take over the South Pacific Polynesian Islands. And they're just trying to make colonies.
Because if they can win wars, they can show that they're badasses.
But of course, this would cause the French to overcompensate. All right, questions?
Now, beginning in the 1870s, going forward for the next 40 years, really one of the most bizarre periods in Western civilization occurred. Technically, it was a period of peace, but it was so bizarre. It was different than anything had ever come before it. It was a time when diplomacy emerged, as opposed to open warfare. But the most fascinating thing was the architect. It was none other than the Iron Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck.
Bismarck instigated the Franco-Prussian War. Bismarck created Germany. And when the Kaiser took the oath, he brought Bismarck in as the Chancellor for Germany. And in this role, Bismarck, as I said last class, and I wasn't exaggerating, was again playing four-dimensional chess, where all the other nations in the world were busy trying to figure out how to play checkers.
He built the peace by controlling geopolitics. The only thing similar that we've ever had in our country was probably someone like Kissinger. Who was Nixon's Secretary of State, in terms of his brilliance with foreign policy. Bismarck would take the imbalance that appeared. New powerful country out of nowhere, weakening the old powerful country. And he would manage to restore balance, to make a new status quo, on which all of the countries wanted to maintain. In other words, he got the other European countries to say, a strong Germany is okay, and a weak France is even better. It's brilliant. He did so by avoiding war. That was his goal. He wanted order. He wanted stability. He didn't want aggression. He didn't want secret manipulations. All of the things that let him get Germany to begin with. So how do you keep the peace? Well, one hand, he wanted to make sure that everybody continued to hate France. Question. Any of you ever engage in fisticuffs? You did?
Oh, yeah.
Got a fist fight? A couple of them?
Played hockey for 12 years.
All right, well, I'm not talking about fisticuffs on the ice. That's kind of a different environment. But you ever just, like, in a cafeteria or something, just got to beat the crap out of somebody? Or did you ever have the crap beaten out of you? No? Okay. All right, well, that's fine. Probably smart. Well, here's the thing. If you're on your own, all by yourself, and you come in contact with a group of people, are you going to puff your chest up and act like a tough guy if you're there by yourself? Why not?
You don't have anyone to impress.
Well, yeah, you don't have no one to impress. In all likelihood, what's going to end up happening if you go against a group?
Not going to be good for you.
Yeah, it's not going to be a good turnout. You'll be rather sore in many places on your body in the next coming days. So Bismarck knew if he could make it so that way everybody continued to hate France, he knew the French were pissed. He knew the French wanted revenge. But he knew that the French leaders would never do a thing against Germany out of fear of what would happen. So how do you make it so that way even the idea is untenable? Well, very simple. You make alliances with other countries. You build a group that is anti-French. So that's point number one. Point number two is also, at least to me, apparent. He knew that Russia and Austria, which now both share his borders, hated one another almost as bad as the Germans hated the French. Problem is the Austro-Hungarian Empire is dominated by the Austrians who are German. So if a war was ever to erupt between Russia and Austria, his people would want to go to war on the side of Austria. But look how much of Germany shares a border with Russia. So if he was to get in this war, it's possible the Russians could come and invade. And guess what part of Germany's right here?
Gdansk, Danzig.
Danzig, which was once in what German state?
Prussia.
Prussia. So Prussia is literally on the Russian border. So if a war was ever to occur, his state would be the first to be invaded. Plus, 26 nations were brought together out of the enemy of my enemy is my friend game. But some of the German states had economic treaties with Russia. And some of them, you would almost be able to argue that maybe they were a little more fond of the Russians than they were the Prussians. So Bismarck knew that if a war was ever to erupt between these two, Germany could shatter, completely fall apart. So Again, three-dimensional chess.
One hand, keep France down. On the other hand, you're holding Russia. And on the other hand, you got to keep Austria at bay. It's almost like Twister.
So how do you do this? Well, he develops one of the most brilliant geopolitical systems ever devised, frequently referred to as his alliance system, in which, to keep it simple, although we're going to go into detail, he made a series of alliances that linked every single one of the major powers in the continent to Germany. And through these connections, they made sure France never had any friends.
Makes sense.
Of course, greatest the irony is this is real politic. He shifted positions. For 10 years, he was all about the war, using war to get what he wanted. Now he's going to use peace to get what he wanted.
All right, so the first attempt at making an alliance system was by literally getting the hands of the three rulers, William I of Germany, Franz Joseph of Austria-Hungary, and Tsar Alexander II, and having them form a loose-knit alliance. And the 19th century term for a loose-knit alliance was a league.
So they didn't have a formal written document, like a treaty, that said what each would do. But rather, they all kind of agreed to cooperate with one another. They focused on keeping the peace. And they also agreed that there was a plague that was infecting Europe. Marxism. So they agreed to collaborate on how to basically crush Marxism in their countries. All right. Now, interestingly enough, both Austria and Russia, from the documents that survived, basically agreed that this was a good idea. And for a period of about 4 years, they had open dialogue. They interacted with one another. Heck, I couldn't find it. I have it on one of my other classes. I should have just copied it out. But there were several photo ops where the three emperors actually gathered together. And they drank and they had meals. So it seemed like everything was going great. But they were yes?
Wasn't the Kaiser and Tsar like first cousins or something?
Not Alexander II. You're thinking of Wilhelm II,
yeah.
Nicholas II.
Yeah.
And they weren't first cousins.
Yeah, wasn't Queen Elizabeth like all their grandmother?
Queen Victoria.
Queen Victoria, yeah, that's what I meant to say.
No. Nicholas was married to Queen Victoria's granddaughter.
Okay.
There's a very stretched out familial blood link between the Romanovs and Queen Victoria. But it goes back to Queen Victoria's great aunt.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a common misconception. But Queen Victoria was pretty much through marriage or blood related to all the monarchs anyway. Well, she was around for like 60 years. She pumped out like 12 kids. So, yeah.
And each of their kids had like 12 kids. So. All right. Austria-Hungary. I didn't know how I had it on there. I almost started saying Austro-Hungarian Empire. Any of you know anything about this country? This empire?
Well, it was a bunch of different states with a bunch of different ethnic peoples. You had Serbs, you had obviously Hungarians, Austrians, you had Czechs. You had all different kinds of different peoples that lived in that country, and they all kind of collectively hated each other.
Yeah. The formal phrase for what you're talking about, it's called the supranationalist country. So it's not a nationalist country, where everybody in the country was one race or ethnic group. But you're right. You had, and here is the major groups. There's about 12 of them. You have the Austrians, who are Germans.
You have the Hungarians, who were technically called Magyars. You had some Czechs, which inhabited Bohemia. You had Slovaks. You had Poles. You had Ukrainians. You had Slovenes. You had Croats. You had Serbs. You had Bosnians. You had Romanians. And plus, you also had another group called the Ruthenian Russians. Something like that. So ethnically speaking, they're Russians, but their ancestors moved in. So yeah, you had a very diverse nation. But here's the irony. Problems after problems after problems. Because there was no such thing as diversity or tolerance back then. Because this state was built through conquest that dated back hundreds of years.
The conquering group were the Austrians. And the Habsburg dynasty dominated it all. But this empire itself was relatively new. It was only created in 1803 out of the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire, which was destroyed by Napoleon. And essentially, it was built by taking the lands held by the Habsburgs in adding on some border territories for stability. So technically it was created by Napoleon. It just stuck. Unfortunately, there was one dominant race or ethnic group, and that was the Germans. They were the largest, but they were a minority. Roughly 23% of the population was ethnically German. But that 23% dominated all of the others. You don't need to know these numbers. About 14% of the population was Hungarian. If you put the Czechs and the Slovaks together, that was about 19%. Slovenes were 4, Croats were 4, Serbs were 5, Ruthenians were 8, Romanians were 8, Italians were 8, Polish were 7. So the problem was one group had all of the rights, all of the privileges, and all of everybody else, all minorities, but if you put them all together, that's a majority, they had little to no rights. Making things even more complicated, there were 17 languages spoken in their country. And there were 7 major religions. And as you can see by the map, sometimes other ethnic groups lived within other traditional homes of other ethnic groups. So you had these pockets. So you couldn't even technically say that this was a Hungarian region because you had Germans living there. You know, it was complicated. It was messy. It was definitely not clean. So, how did the government, controlled by a minority, control the majority population?
Assumed for force.
That's part of it. But how much force could 23% of the population use against 77%?
Officer, a soldier, and you're starving, and your family's starving, are you really going to question what the guy above you is telling you to do? Not really, because you don't have a choice. You got your family at home.
Yeah, but if you have one police officer, and he has one gun, and he comes across 60 people with clubs, who's going to win?
I mean, obviously, you'll just convince one. You get a bunch of them, or you convince a bunch of them, I guess. It's power is like a different...
It's a huge power dynamic. But do you know how the Austrians managed to defuse the majority population? You got an idea?
I mean, it also probably doesn't help that they all hate each other.
That's exactly it. They all hated one another.
Yeah.
It wasn't like it was everybody against the Austrians. The Hungarians hated the Czechs, who hated the Serbs, who hated the Slovakians. Everybody hated each other.
And the Serbs hated everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So you know what the Germans did? They played everybody against each other. Oh, you want to support us because you know what they're doing? So they knew who hated one another and they played that. It was done through complete manipulation. So you pit one another, each other, and then you divide and conquer. By the way, that's utilized in our country's political system. Why do you think they're constantly trying to divide us into races or regions or political opinions? And don't focus on the fact that we're all Americans.
Well, to get us to hate one another so that behind the scenes when we're not paying attention, they're slowly stripping our rights away from us so that they have all the power and they can oppress us.
That's exactly what how the Austrians maintain control. What times change, but they always stay the same. All right. Now, here's the truth of the matter is, sometimes things do get out of control. And we don't have time. We're not going to get into it. I'm just going to just mention it. But in Western civilization, 1848 was the year in which Europe almost imploded. It's commonly referred to as the Year of Revolutions. Every single major country on the continent had revolutions. France, there was several revolutions that broke out in the German states. There was revolutions in Italy. And of course, there was a big revolution in the Austrian Empire, as it was called then. Nationalist movements erupted in which, for the first time, the Hungarians saw themselves as Hungarians. The Czechs saw themselves as Czechs. The Italians were like, why the heck are we even part of this country? We want to go back with our ethnic group. And the Austrians barely managed to survive. The empire was bankrupted. The police state almost turned on itself. But out of sheer luck, the Austrians managed to prevail by making a token offering to the Hungarians. We will give you domestic sovereignty. We will let you control domestically what happens in your province. We will stay out of it if you join with us. So the combined Austrian and Hungarian troops were able to beat down everybody else. This agreement was formalized in 1867 when the Emperor Franz Joseph formally implemented what's known as the Ostgleich. The Ostgleich, which is German for compromise. In 1867, a new constitution was drafted in which a dual monarchy was formed. He, besides being the emperor, would simultaneously be the king of Austria and the king of Hungary. Both countries would have their own parliaments. Both countries would have their own ministries, their own departments. And at certain times, the emperor could travel between the two, so long as both agreed to work together, power would be shared.
So the Hungarian people were brought up, societally speaking, to the same level of rights and equality and power as the Germans. Bizarre partnership, let me tell you. But to keep all the other groups in line, in the Constitution, there were other compromises that were thrown in. So it was declared that no longer could there be inferior or superior status in the law. Everyone would become citizens. Everyone was allowed to use their own language. So if you were Czech, you wanted to speak your Czech language, your Bohemian language, have at it, that's fine. And you could control your local government. So you could elect town officials. But even though these were put into the Constitution, doesn't mean they were always followed. There was still discrimination. But with this new union, it allowed them basically to kind of ratchet everything down. So much so
that once they took control of their heartland, they began looking to expand. And they decided to go with border expansion. Because in the Balkans, the political dynamic was changing. The Ottomans, which once controlled all the way up to the gates of Vienna, were slowly dying. And these people were breaking away, having revolutions. So the Austrians sat back and said, well, let's see if we can scoop up some of the weaker states.
And the Hungarians were all on board with it. Because who doesn't like a little conquest every now and then? So they begin their drive into the Balkans at the same time as Russia looks to do the same. Now, the Russian Empire was, geographically speaking, huge. It was one of the largest empires ever stitched together. And going back to the ascension of the Romanovs, for 300 years, it just grew and grew and grew and grew. In fact, they actually had possession over here of Alaska for a while, until we bought it. Seward's Folly. Interestingly enough, Russia also had problems because, like Austria, it also was a supranationalist state and it had tons of its own issues. So, how do you compensate for issues? Just like Austria, police state. Oh, I have the stat. The Russian Empire at its height equaled 1/6 of all land on Earth. In total mileage, you don't have to remember this at all, but it was 8.6 million square miles. It stretched from Poland and Finland all the way to the Pacific. And it went from the Arctic all the way down to the Caucasus, and of course down to Turkestan and Mongolia. But it too had a minority in charge. What we would call the Russian people only represented about 45% of the total population. The rest was one of about 1,000 ethnic groups who spoke about 30 different languages, who worshipped 16 different religions. And the vast majority, about 90%, were agricultural peasants. There was little to no industry. There were no factories. They did not experience the Industrial Revolution. But unlike in Austria-Hungary, where the minorities were busy fighting against one another, the one common thread throughout the Russian Empire was that nobody wanted to be controlled by Russia. They all, at different times, attempted to break away. So to compensate, the czars had to implement a police state. The most significant architect of this was the Tsar Alexander II. The very same guy that joined the Three Emperors League. He tried fixing the problem. He tried. I'll give you a couple of examples, but you don't have to remember these for the exam. 1861, he declared that serfdom was abolished. No longer were the peasants treated like slaves, which meant they literally, if they wanted to, could leave the land in which their ancestors had been working on since time immemorial. If they wanted to go to the city, they could. He hoped that that labor would migrate to the cities, and he hoped to begin industrialization. Of course, the problem was, is most of the people stayed where they had always been because they knew nothing different. So He hoped that a middle class would grow, but it was really small. Really small. And he had to deal with the nobles, who were angry at the fact that he abolished serfdom. So here's some of the big impacts. During serfdom, the serfs were required to pay a form of taxation to their lord. They had to give about 40% of whatever they produced. That went to the noble. The noble then could consume it or sell it or do whatever he wanted. But the moment serfdom was abolished, that revenue went away. So the nobles were livid. So the Tsar decided to give compensation to the nobles. He started paying the nobles out of the national treasury money in the form of reparations. He said, if you don't like it, you can sell your lands and make money that way. But the problem was, is under the Russian system, even the nobles didn't own the lands on which they lived. They were all technically leased from the Tsar. So, you can't sell the land, what are you going to do? You just had this ever seemingly worsening system. And of course, this triggered a whole new round of problems.
Revolutions started appearing. Revolutions that sought to possibly assassinate and or topple the regime.
He survived. I think it's like 7 assassination attempts after he emancipated the serfs. It was crazy. So, we have all of these problems internally. What's the best way to compensate?
War.
Yeah, let's go to war. Let's go attack and distract everybody. So, just as the Austrians were trying to control the minorities and look to expansion to hide the mistakes, so too were the Russians. And you know where they really wanted to get into? They wanted to get down in here to the Balkans. Does anyone know why?
Access to the seaports.
They needed a warm water port. It's great that they had all this territory. But what happens up here?
Freezes.
Oh, it gets effing cold. You think we're cold? It gets worse. Even though they had some North Sea access through the Baltic Sea, the problem was even those ports froze. So the only way to keep an economy going was he needed warm water access. He had control of the Crimea and the Caucasus. Most of modern Ukraine was part of the empire. The problem is he couldn't get out because the Ottomans were there. Yeah, they were controlling the Bosphorus. So he wanted to move down into the Balkans. At the same time, the Austrians were looking to move down to the Balkans because the Ottomans themselves were slowly losing their empire. Have you ever put your hand into a pizza box when there's one last slice at the same time your buddy does? Who's going to get it?
You're stronger, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, questions? All right, so let's go back to the Three Emperors League. So everything was going great until that first hand slap occurred when both put their hands into the pizza box at the same time to get the last slice. And ironically, the event that caused it originally had nothing to do with either Austria or Russia. But it was another war. In 1877, a revolutionary movement would occur in which Montenegro, Serbia, and Romania would launch a revolution against their Ottoman overlords and attempt to declare independence. But one of the countries The Bulgarians held back. The Bulgarians held back because they didn't think they could do it themselves, because unlike the Romanians and the Serbs and the Bosnians and the Montenegrins, they were the buffer state. So if they would attempt to rebel, they feared that the Ottomans would simply roll into their country and commit atrocities. So they waited, they waited, they waited until 1876. When the Ottomans did nothing about the other countries, they decided to make a go at it. 1876, Bulgaria declares its independence. Oh wait, I'm doing this. There we go. 1876, Bulgaria declares its independence, and just as they feared, the Turks invaded, and they perpetrated massive atrocities. It's believed that the Turkish soldiers killed upwards of 100,000 people, men, women, children, as they literally set villages on fire. Well, while Bulgaria began to burn, their leaders reached out to Russia and asked for help. If they helped, look, they're slowly taking more, wait, where am I at? More and more and more control over the Black Sea. And they're getting closer and closer and closer to the Bosphorus. So that's why Russia would declare war against Turkey. They went to war to save the Bulgarians. But the problem is, this suddenly created an international crisis. Because, one, most of the European countries had lent money to the Ottomans. If the Ottoman regime was completely toppled, they're not going to get paid back. Two, if the Russians win and are able to start distributing their goods out into the Mediterranean, you now have competition. A, with the recently created Suez Canal, which the British would eventually take control over, as well as the French, who are taking more and more control over North Africa. So if Russia wins, England and France loses. So we can't let them win. So much to the chagrin of Russia, England and France, they didn't formally declare war, but they declared their support of the Ottomans. And they sent weapons, they sent battleships, and it allowed the Ottomans to fight the Russians to a draw. But the Ottomans knew it was unsustainable, so they begged for peace. And the Russians agreed. So in 1878, the Russians and the Ottomans work out a unilateral treaty. The Treaty of San Stefano. And this is basically what would go down. And I'm going to give you the most important parts. Bulgaria would be given its autonomy. So it would be allowed to control itself. But it would remain in the empire. Whereas the other states, Romania, Serbia, and Montenegro, they would be given their independence. But here's the big stinker. Russia and Bulgaria would maintain a military alliance. And the Ottomans would allow the Russians to access the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus. They wouldn't stop Russian ships. Russia's the hero. Russia actually wins a war. Now they have close alliances with Bulgaria, the Romanians, the Serbians, the Montenegrins. They love Russia because Russia helped them get their freedom. All is good. Oh, by the way, they're also all Eastern Christian churches. So, to a degree, Russia can become the next Rome. This is wonderful. Brilliant. Except for it messes with Bismarck's balance of power. England is outraged. France is outraged. But you know who's also outraged?
Germany.
No, not Germany. Germany doesn't care. But there's a group of German peoples that have a border with the Balkans that were suddenly looking to move into the Balkans.
Austria.
Oh yeah, the Austrians. So, the Austrians contact the British, who are the most powerful empire on earth, and the Austrian says, you know something, it's not right that the Russians did this. And the British agreed. So they called for a conference. Let's have a gathering of diplomats. And let's see if we can figure out an amicable solution. A solution that everybody agrees with. And guess who volunteers to host? Bismarck.
What a nice guy.
Oh, yeah. Because again, like I said, four-dimensional, three-dimensional chess. He's going to completely manipulate the terms to benefit him. So, all of the world's powers gather. And they all sit down and they discuss. And you know, they decide that the Treaty of San Stefano, that's just not fair. So we're going to scrap it. We're going to get rid of it. And we're going to change up some of the terms. Russia would be allowed to keep all the territory that it took on the far side of the Black Sea. FYI, they drove down and took control of the northern half of the ancient kingdom of Armenia. Don't have to worry about that for now. But in the Balkans, no. No military alliance with Bulgaria. And Bulgaria would be shrunk. It would shrink to 30% of the state that Russia wanted to create. Russia's livid. They wanted a foothold in the Balkans. They also wanted access to the Dardanelles, the Bosporus, to which now Constantinople couldn't say no. But even more interesting, I'm going to go back to the map, was what happened to the former Ottoman territories closest to Austria, which is now just about completely severed from the empire by the creation of Montenegro, Serbia, and Romania. Two territories called Bosnia and Herzegovina. Austria, being the gentlemen that they were, declared, we would send our troops in there and we would help protect it. We would police the state for the Ottomans because we're good friends with the Turks. Tell me a time in history when a foreign country sent their army into a country for the well-being of another. Never. Prior to the United States.
Never.
Never. But of course, all of the nations were like, oh yeah, this is really good. Because deep down in the back of their mind is like, okay, we're essentially blocking Russia from getting into the Mediterranean. We don't have to worry about their competition. Game, set, match. And all the while, Bismarck declares, we want nothing. We want nothing. We're just happy that we can help broker this peace.
Now, of course, for our discussion, one of the biggest consequences of the Berlin Conference was now Tsar Nicholas II was absolutely bullshit. He was livid. And he announced he was no longer going to participate in the Three Emperors League. He wanted nothing to do with the traitors. Which does create a problem. Because now Russia is angry and they've broken away from Bismarck's control. Bismarck now has a problem with Russia. But he knows the Tsar, economically, militarily, are weak. So it's not like Russia is going to suddenly declare war on Germany. But they may declare war on Austria to get revenge. So the most effective way to prevent Russia from declaring war on Austria is what?
Forming an official alliance with them?
Yeah. Formally form an alliance with Austria. But truth be told, there's another threat. Serbia. So we know Russia is a threat to the peace. But Serbia suddenly becomes a peace. And here's one of the reasons why World War I occurred. The Serbians claimed, historically, Bosnia was part of the ancient kingdom of Serbia. That the Bosnians were Serbs. That, racially speaking, it's not right that the Austrians and the Hungarians now have control over their people. So they are angry. Because what the hell do the Austro-Hungarians have to do anything with Bosnia or Herzegovina? So now we have the other possibility of a conflict, if you will. If a war was to erupt between Serbia and Austria, things could get messy in the Balkans. But if a war was to erupt between Russia and Austria, things could get messy in Germany. So the best way to prevent both is by doing what we just said. Let's join together to make an alliance with Austria.
Technically, this becomes known as the dual alliance. What do we got here? Schulter an Schulter und trennbar Verent in Freund und in Leid.
State and state joined together in friendship and in love.
Brilliant move. Brilliant move. Because Bismarck was clever. The dual alliance was a defensive treaty. Only. Not an offensive treaty. A defensive treaty. Here's how it works. If Russia was to attack either Germany or Austria, Deutschland oder Österreich, the other nation would declare war on Russia. But if either country were attacked by anyone else, neutrality. So if Serbia was to go to war with Austria, Bismarck could turn around and say, yep, not my problem. It only applied to Russia.
Now here's the dirty little secret. This was a secret treaty. But just like the Ems telegram, somehow Russian spies got their hands on the treaty and it was sent to the Tsar.
No way.
What?
I said no way.
Oh, yeah, I know, but I know. And the treaty that the Tsar got removed the defensive quota and made it look like it was an offensive treaty. That if Austria was ever to attack Russia, Russia, Germany may join in. Which caused the Tsar to freak out.
But you know what was never recorded? A secret document that wasn't discovered until about 50 years later that Bismarck sent to the Austrian Prime Minister, in which he basically laid out that under no circumstance would Germany ever declare war on Russia. So the Russians think, oh my God, they're going to attack me. But the Austrians know, oh geez, if we attack Russia, we're on our own. Ching, 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 ching. But, it set fear into Russia. But you know what also was terrifying at the same exact time? Tsar Alexander II's luck ran out. He was blown up when one of those radical assassins threw a bomb underneath his carriage while he was traveling through St. Petersburg. And as this wonderful artistic representation shows, his carriage got blown it up. Killed by a radical Marxist. So, shortly after taking the throne, his son, Alexander III, although indignant, angry at Bismarck, frustrated how Bismarck seemingly is controlling everything, decides to reform the Three Emperors League.
Oh, I'm sure Bismarck was laughing all the way to the bank.
Questions? Let me do it one time. Not too shabby. One last thing and then we'll call it a day. At around the same time the dual alliance is formed, at around the same time the Three Emperors League is brought back, another series of developments is occurring in Europe. And that is the emergence of another unified state that finds itself alone and decides it wants in on the action. In 1882, Italy contacts Bismarck and asks if he, or if Italy and Germany, can kind of form a dual alliance type of system as well. See, Italy, at the same time Austria and Russia were going at the Balkans, Italy decided it, after it unified an event known as Risorgimento, which is just the reunion. This new kingdom is established, and what do they want to do? They want to flex their muscles. They want to show that they are strong, that they are the descendants of Rome. So the reunified state decides it wants to engage in conquest. But here's the interesting thing. It really made no sense. So you could kind of see the writing on the wall in Germany. There was a bunch of economic alliances between Prussia and several of the German states. They formed the North German Confederation. Like, everything as it played out was kind of obvious. But in Italy, really all the way up into the 1860s, Italy was made up of 16 separate states and each one hated one another. But unification was formed by the Italian Bismarck, a man by the name of Count Camillo Cavour. Cavour was a practitioner of realpolitik, not a master like Bismarck, but he was definitely a good practitioner. He would use realpolitik in a way similar to the way Bismarck used it in the 1860s. He instigated a series of war as prime minister from one of the larger Italian countries, the Kingdom of Piedmont, which also controlled Sardinia. And he manipulated events to get his goal. Because again, if you play realpolitik, even wars are on the table. Don't need to remember this. 1859, there was what was called the Second War of Italian Independence, in which Piedmont would take from Austria the territory of Lombardy, which is over here, added it to their kingdom. At the same time, smaller states voted to make an alliance with Piedmont. Then in 1860, there was the Sicilian Rebellion. During the chaos, Piedmont sends its army down and conquers the Kingdom of Naples. And the Sicilian revolutionaries liked Piedmont more than it liked Naples. So they formed an alliance. And then eventually the Papal States, controlled by the Pope, said, well, we'll join Piedmont too. Eventually, the King of Piedmont was declared the King of Italy. And bit by bit, they slowly started adding its pieces. And once together, they wanted to expand. But unlike what was going on in the Balkans, they looked south. They eyeballed Libya and possibly Tunisia. But of course, the problem was, at the same time they looked down, the French, after being humiliated by the Prussians, wants to flex its muscles. So now you have these two countries putting their hand into the same pizza box. And it's a real possibility that there could be a war between Italy and France. So, why did the Italians reach out? Very simple. Leverage. The French are weak. They know they can't beat the Germans. So if we're friends with the Germans, it's unlikely that the French are going to attack us. All diplomatic moves. By the way, one of the reasons why Italy approached Bismarck is somehow, amazingly, the terms of the dual alliance translated to Italian ended up in the Italian government's hands, even though it was supposed to be a secret treaty that was written in German.
And it was enough to make the Italian prime minister sit back and say, we could get in on this. But here's the deal. The terms that Bismarck granted were the same he gave to Austria. Defensive treaty. If France attacks either Germany or Italy, the other will declare war. But if anyone else attacks, neutrality. And you know what he told the Italians? Similar to what he told the Austrians. We're never going to declare war on France because France doesn't have the balls to declare war on us.
And thus, this will be the last click. Oh, wait, no, I got a minute. Now, I'll just give you the click so I can fill this in and then we'll finish it because it doesn't make sense to end half-assedly. So here you go.
This is a nice graph, but I like this one as well, because in there's Bismarck, there's the Kaiser, and look, they're simultaneously controlling everything. They, through alliances, have an alliance with Austria, Italy, while simultaneously have the Three Emperors League, which brings Russia into the picture as well. France has no friends. Because nobody likes the French, see?
Well, the poor little French girl is crying because nobody likes her.
But here's something we'll talk more in detail about next class. What about England? England didn't care what was going on in the continent because they had the largest global empire on earth. That's what they were worried about. And Bismarck knew it. So, last thought. So long as Bismarck holds these guys' hands and convinces England, Germany's never going to try to get colonies. England's going to worry about itself. These guys are linked. No one cares about Spain. Spain's pathetic. So France is going to be all by itself. And thus, peace is achieved.
Brilliant.
Questions? Now, FYI, I'm giving you a lot of introductory details. I'm not going to expect you to know the depth. That's why I'm kind of going quick. I'm just kind of giving you stuff to kind of get in the back of your head, so that way as the dominoes start falling, you can sit back and say, oh, this happened because of that. So if you missed anything, don't worry. It's not like I'm going to be brutally in my exam and ask you what happened in this way on this day. Okay? Topics? Do 1 week from Friday. Be careful tomorrow. We're going to get a snowpocalypse. Another inch of snow is going to potentially fall. But on a serious note, stay warm, because I think Saturday, Sunday, it's supposed to get really cold. So just be mindful of that. Safe, be happy, my friends. We'll see you on Tuesday.